Heritage Oral Education Project, July 15, 1985. Interview with Alda Natteru at Morehead State University Library. Interviewer Larry Burns. Alda, could you share with us initially a little bit about where you are now in terms of your career, your retirement, and other things that you're doing at the present time?
Yes. I retired 8 years ago from public school work. In the last 8 years, I've worked off and on for both Concordia and Morehead State University, primarily in their student teaching supervision program. The last 2 years, I think I worked with well over 50 students, about 19 schools, 75 or so different high school supervisors. So I picked up a pretty good background of what's going on in the schools today. I've also taught some of the college classes. I think 2 or 3 years ago I had a sequence in basic foundations of education. So it's been an interesting period of retirement. I've kept fairly busy.
Okay. Do you share with us, going back to the place of your birth and your early upbringing, where that was and experiences you remember, a little bit about your family background?
We moved a lot in my younger days. I was born in Lanesboro, Minnesota, way back about 1920, and we lived primarily in cities in Houston and in Fillmore County, southeastern Minnesota. I did spend the first few years of my elementary school years in a place called Zumbrota, Minnesota, and then 8 years in Spring Grove, Minnesota. And I graduated from Chatfield High School in 1938. I spent a year working and then enrolled in Winona State. At that time, it was Winona State Teachers College in 39. 3 years there, and then 3.5 years teaching in the service, Air Corps. I returned to Winona in 46 and finished my bachelor's degree, and then I went on to University of Minnesota to pursue graduate work. Received the M.A. there in the summer of 47, and I began teaching at that time. My first teaching job was a principalship at Nicollet, Minnesota, as well as a full load of teaching. And then 3 years at Mabel, Minnesota, 5 years at Pipestone, and I came to Morehead in 1956 and was a senior high principal in Morehead for 21 years.
Okay. Over the years, do you recall a point at which you decided that teaching would be a career for you? Was that a long-time decision or a sudden decision?
I think it developed primarily through some encouragement by my minister, who felt that I should be, and my social studies teacher in high school, they kept insisting I should be in teaching. My dad was a pharmacist, and my goal was to become a druggist. But then it so happened that we moved to Winona, Minnesota, just about 2 blocks from Winona State Teachers College at that time, and so it was just natural for me to attend school there. Some of my advisors kept encouraging me to go in teaching, and then, of course, I did some teaching, ground school teaching in the Air Corps, and I think I was pretty convinced that I would pursue teaching after my experience in the Air Corps.
Did you consider any other possibilities? Did you have any pressure to go into pharmacy or other lines of work?
My dad talked me out of pharmacy. Back in those days, the druggists would get up at 7 in the morning, and they'd close down the store about 10 in the evening, and they'd work Sundays, and he thought teaching was had a much better future than pharmacy.
Was it associated with the time off in the summer? Was that part of the rationale?
No, nothing to do with it. I think the key, as I said, was my experience in the Army, Air Corps, directly involved in individualized type of teaching, but very interesting. Then the college, just a few blocks from home, plus encouragement from, as I said before, from my minister and some of the people that I worked with. I enjoyed the subject matter very much. I did a lot of work with science in the Air Corps, and I developed a good background in science, meteorology, and a lot of the related sciences and aeronautics. And I just enjoyed the field. Although I majored in social studies, I was primarily interested in science.
How did you get your first job?
Well, I got a telephone call from the director of the Bureau at the University of Minnesota saying the gentleman from Nicollet, Minnesota wanted to talk to you. So I went over to the placement bureau, and he wanted me to, he liked the idea that I was qualified for administration and also could teach science and social studies. Was interested in coaching. He thought I would fit well into his school system. So that's how I got my first job.
Did you, in your first job, do all of those things? Science and social science and coaching and so on?
I enjoy telling the present-day teachers what my initial teaching load was. I started out with chemistry in the morning. Then I followed that with a senior social studies class. And then with an eighth grade, no, then with the American history class, an eighth grade class in social studies. Then I had, at that time, a lot of programs, because of school buses, where the FIAD programs were run during the noon hour, so then I was teaching FIAD during the noon hour. In the afternoon, I had another history class. Then I think I finished the day. Well, I had a biology class in there someplace, too. The last period of the seven-period day was devoted to being a high school principal. Now, there was one interesting thing. I had no lunch break. So the superintendent said, no, you take your eighth-grade history class, the last 20 minutes of the class, and send them in the study hall, and you can go eat. So that was my lunch hour.
Did you do any coaching that first
year? Yes,
I
was hired to coach football. And I didn't care too much for football. I had some background in basketball. The football, the basketball coach didn't like basketball. He wanted to coach football, so we traded jobs, and I coached basketball. Mm-hmm. Also, a casual statement in the interview, we may need a senior play director. I don't think it'll develop, but just in case, would you be willing to take it? I said, okay. Sure enough, along about the middle of the school year, he reminded me that I was willing to take the job as senior class play with no background whatsoever in drama. But, we made it.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall either the first day or the first week any particular incidences or your perceptions of all those responsibilities?
Well, not really. If you remember that period of time, we were all back from the Army, and the veteran back in 1947 had a pretty good image. And the fact that I think I had been in the service for 3.5 years, it was a very easy adjustment. The kids respected the old Army man, so to speak. You could relate some of the experiences. You could tie it up with your classwork. The thing that I remember full well was that every night I would work until late to keep at least a chapter or so ahead of the kids and the five or six subjects that I had. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. What was the first school like? The physical setting, the classroom setting, the kinds of equipment you used or the materials that you used?
I would say it was an old building. It was a typical 1920 vintage. The curriculum was typical 1920 curriculum. Every student took the same basic classes, practically no electives. I believe they did have some remnants of the Smith-Hughes program, and they did have a shop class. And they did have home economics. Otherwise, it was just basic geometry, history, English, social studies, FIAD.
Do you recall the number of students you had in those classes?
Average was about 23 to 25. I remember we graduated 23 seniors. I'll never forget that because it was so much easier than years later when we were graduating 526 at Moorhead. I kind of miss those days of just calling 23 seniors.
Were you observed or evaluated during that first year by the principal or other teachers?
One period, about half the period, my biology class was in the combination chemistry and physics classroom, and the superintendent was a physics teacher. And he came into the room and was working around back, presumably working on some physics equipment, and I didn't know whether he was getting ready for his physics class or if he was checking up on me. But that was about it. It's the only observation any place.
Anyone any comments about your performance during that first year?
I didn't say a word. The students I had a pretty sharp class of biology students, and they suspected, I think, he was checking up on me, and they responded beautifully. We got involved in some review material, and these kids were raising their hands, and they really made me look good. I always felt pretty good about that. But he never commented.
Frequently, teachers comment today about the interruptions with the intercom and elementary teachers, but with milk money and Red Cross and so on. In your first teaching job, do you recall the kind of interrupters that were not unique to you, but were a general part of being a teacher in those days?
Oh, I can tell you the first three jobs that I had involved a total of 9 years' experience. We had no PA system, practically no interruptions. We would have a daily bulletin that would be delivered and was to be read by the teacher at precisely 11 o'clock, and that was about it. Very few interruptions.
Any class parties, carnivals, plays, and so on?
There was always some of that, yes. But it wasn't a burden. Typical homecoming dance and maybe one carnival and the two class plays and maybe a banquet and a prom, and that was about it.
Any students leaving class for athletics or other sorts of activities?
That came later. I would say it wasn't until I came to Moorhead that we started to run into quite a bit of that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you remember during that time, just strictly boys athletics, no girls program. Mm-hmm. And even then, the interruptions were practically non-existent until the spring program when you started working with baseball, golf, tennis, and track. At that time, it was pretty difficult. Schools made an honest effort to have most of the events on Saturdays, but it didn't always work that way. Mm-hmm. So I would say the spring, especially in May, was pretty difficult as far as at least the high school is concerned. Mm-hmm.
During that period of time, in many agricultural areas, there was an adjustment or an accommodation of the school calendar for the harvest and other sorts of agricultural activities. Was that the case in your school?
The first 4 years, we had a little of that in the fall, but it wasn't, the schools had a little leverage that maybe they didn't deserve to have, but they had it anyway. And they made it difficult in terms of makeup for students that had to miss. As a result, we were running, even during those early years, we were running 96% attendance. So it really wasn't a problem. But as I say, the key in those first years, the teachers were very insistent upon students making up the work. And when that kind of philosophy disappeared in later years, then your attendance picture became a little more difficult.
But that first job, it wasn't noticeable. Okay. In addition to coaching and taking on the drama eventually. Did you have any other duties, hall duty or lunch duty or other sorts of duties that teachers frequently get involved in historically?
No. Didn't have a lunch period, so I didn't have to worry about lunch duty that first year. Those first years, I would say, it wasn't until I got to Pipestone, and Pipestone was a full-time principalship. There was no combination teaching. Pipestone had a senior high enrollment of around 400. We had usually one or two key people that were given release time to supervise during the lunch period. And I always made it a point to be available during the lunch period. I think that was just the presence of the people, I think, helped a lot. And it was fair because the supervisors were given release time to do this. It wasn't an additional duty. It was part of their basic teaching load. Mm-hmm. And that philosophy was maintained all through the 30 years I was a high school principal. We did not give the teachers additional burdens unless it was part of their assignment.
Where did you live during that first job? What kind of place did you have?
Just a room. Just a room in a rooming home.
Okay. Was that standard accommodation for a teacher at that time?
At that time, yes. There'd always be certain people in town that would have rooms, and they would rooms for the teachers. And teachers would you go back to the 30s and 40s. Very few schools had a typical lunch program during the day. Most of the teachers would eat at the local restaurant. It wasn't until later that these extensive and efficient lunch programs were developed.
In the community, were you asked to assume any particular responsibilities as part of your obligation as a teacher?
Well, it was voluntary, but I think expected. We taught Sunday school. We joined the local Lions Club. And if there's any church activity that needed additional help, the teachers, I think, were pretty much counted on to help out. There was never any pressure. They just understood that, well, that's part of our role, and I think we played it and played it quite well.
Mm-hmm. Continuing along that point, were there community behavior standards that teachers were expected to maintain that might have impinged on some teachers' lifestyle?
I don't recall any particular problem. I think we knew what the standards were, and I think we as teachers pretty well lived up to these standards. We were conservative and well-mannered, and I think our lifestyle was just about what the community expected, and I think we played the role pretty well, and I think most of us played it because we were sincere in this role, and it was comfortable.
Do you recall any incident where a teacher, either for mode of dress or consumption of alcohol or smoking or other sort of behavior was chastised?
Well, I can go back to the first three schools and I can think of no incidents that developed. Mm-hmm. You must remember now, by that period of time, from the 40s on, teachers as well as the general public were pretty mobile. They had good transportation facilities, and they had automobiles, and they were able to leave the community. There were no rules at that particular time that they had to stay in the community. So I think the teachers are pretty free to their own lifestyle. Basically, and this is something that might be difficult to prove, but I think most superintendents, most principals in the hiring process looked very carefully for the conservative, traditional type of person. I think there was a lot of screening, some guessing, at that level, which I think a lot of double-checking around to see, well, what type of person is this? The recommendation, paper recommendations, remember at that time, were strictly confidential. We didn't have this Privacy Act, I think, of 1974 or something.
Correct.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
So a superintendent, if he did his homework, could do a pretty good job of hiring the type of teacher that he wanted for his school system. Mm-hmm. You remember back in those early days, the law on supply and demand was still in favor of the school and the hiring administrators.
You made some reference to students being pretty receptive to the authority of the teacher at that time. Would that also relate to the parents and the general public and in their attitude about teachers and teaching?
I think so. I think as I look back in those first two or three years, the support of the community was pretty solid in terms of the teacher's role and in terms of discipline. I can remember a community leader telling me, your job is to carry the big stick. And we respect you for that and we'll support you. And I always remember that. They knew, even students would say, well, I dislike principals, but I don't dislike you. And I'd say, well, no, I'm the principal. What's the difference? Well, there is a difference. You have a job to do as a principal, but I don't dislike you as a person. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the authority image made our job a little easier until the 60s. Mm-hmm. And then another thing you have to remember too. Yeah, people forget this. But in the 70s, the holding power was very high in a place like Minnesota. In the 40s and 50s, it was fairly low. There were a lot of dropouts, and the type of dropouts tended to be the students that might be a bit difficult to handle. Whereas in the 70s, you were getting just about all of the teenagers of school-age level were in school.
Did the group of teachers in your school system or in your building share thoughts about teaching, or did they socialize much together, or were you pretty much individual teachers and didn't associate much outside of the building?
Well, we've talked about this many times. The first three positions I had, the first three communities, practically all of our social life was involved with fellow teachers. We all came in about the same time, about the same age level, had the same interest, and we shared an awful lot. We had a lot of social gatherings after ball games, and we'd play golf. It was really the friendship patterns were pretty much limited by design, I guess, and desire to our fellow teachers and fellow workers. And we've often mentioned that we kind of missed that fraternity when we moved into a bigger school system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not that we always had a big happy family, but it was always staff was pretty unified in terms of thinking, in terms of behavior, in terms of interest, and a lot of practically the whole group was involved in any social functions that might develop.
As you look back on that first position and its subsequent positions, were there strategic points where you observed the curriculum changing? And if so, when did that occur and in what way?
Well, the biggest change came. Well, there was a significant change after World War II because two things happened after World War II that I think were very important. First of all, the personnel programs of the Army and the Navy, the services, were pretty much geared toward testing and counseling and interviewing and trying to place service people into their proper role in the service. And that whole guidance concept, counseling concept, was picked up pretty much by the schools after World War II and eventually became a part of the school system. And you begin to see concerns for the individual and individual programs. But the big curriculum change didn't come until after Sputnik. Sputnik was, from the standpoint of a high school principal, one of the biggest blessings that you could get, because it gave us a chance to make some changes. The community, it was a very negative thing nationwide, but it really helped at the local level. And then out of that came Sputnik came out, so a lot of NDA programs and so on. But then the Conant report came along, and James Conant came out in a very positive way, made a very, very comprehensive study of high schools. He came out with his recommendations, and he was our hero, because so many of this whole idea of the comprehensive high school, including in that beginning of the vocational program, the beginning of guidance and counseling. We had guidance counseling all the way back to the 40s, but not really to the extent that it reached after Sputnik. We got involved languages, a total program. There were a lot of changes. Then the next big change came in the late 60s, when I don't know how it started. It started in each community. We started going to a massive system of semester classes. English was, instead of English 10, English 11, English 12, you had 30 or 40 electives that the students could take. And the whole elective system developed in the late 60s. And that gave, well, in Morehead High, we had over 146 classes. And everything went by was, with a few exceptions, was by choice. You had to take your English and your social studies and your science, but there were subjects within in these areas that you could use to meet these requirements. And suddenly, our whole requirement system became a system of choice. And it had a lot of blessings. It had some pitfalls, too. But that was a big change. And, of course, the next change in the curriculum, we're in that era now where you had the boards of education. The retrenchment was the big key in the late 70s, and that cut out some programs. But then, of course, you had all your court cases and all your government programs that added to the curriculum. So it was a series of events that led to some positive changes. It's something that you could spend 4 or 5 hours dealing with, but there's always seemed to be some major event that led to the change, like World War II or the 1954 Supreme Case or Sputnik or the Civil Rights Movement or the title programs or the programs for the handicapped. There's always something, plus the tremendous growth of the vocational program. They all seem to develop from about 60 to about present time.
Previously, you noted that you enjoy telling prospective teachers or current teachers about your teaching load that you had originally, or the special duties you had. In your subsequent positions, did you see an alteration in the kind of teaching load you had, or the nature of the teaching load or the special duties?
You have to remember, from about 1960 on, we had a tremendous growth pattern in secondary education. But the growth wasn't a convenient type of thing. You'd end up needing a teacher who could teach two sections of English and three sections of German, or two sections of science and two sections of Phi Ed. It didn't come out even so you could hire teachers with a straight load. So in the early 60s, we were hiring many people who had double majors because they could fit a role. And eventually some of those could move into a full-time German teacher or a full-time English teacher. But I can think of our present Phi Ed teachers. They came in with the need to teach half Phi Ed and half English. So then we'd have to look for an English Phi Ed combination. And I think the teachers appreciated that. I think even today, most teachers dislike five straight classes of American history. They like a little change in pace. or five classes of typing. They would just plead to have a break, maybe a couple of bookkeeping classes or something. So it wasn't a change from seven or six preparations to one. It was a change from unreasonable teaching load to a rather optimum situation where the teachers could teach in a couple of areas, and most teachers appreciated that. Mm-hmm. We tried once in a while you'd find someone who'd want five state geometries, but not usually. They appreciated a little break.
Mm-hmm. From the point of your first position or so, where you indicated that the community and the students were fairly receptive to your authority as a teacher and were strongly supportive, can you share with me how that might have changed over the years in terms of student receptivity to teachers' authority as well as community relationships with teachers and schools?
Well, of course, the protest era, the Vietnamese era, high school students were about 3 years behind college students. So the protest, just about the time the protest era was decreasing at the college level, and that takes you back to about 1970, 71, the high schools had that gap, about a three-year gap. And the first 3 years of the 70s were rather difficult, and it was also the beginning of the drug problem in the schools. Then you added to that the legislature in Minnesota changed the drinking age to 18, which made a big impact on the actual problems that we might have in school. Counselors in school, St. Paul, were telling me that the problems they used to have with juniors 10 years ago, they're having with 7th and 8th graders now. It just changed the whole situation. So it was that desire for freedom that came during those protest years, plus it was a case of the conflicting double R's. They wanted the responsibility. They didn't want the responsibility. They wanted the rights. I guess that's the best way to put it. The rights movement. They were talking about due process. They were talking about their rights, and they picked us from the press and from the media, but they didn't at the same time want to assume the responsibility. So there was a period. But interestingly, there's a paradox that it's quite a hard. The most difficult time in secondary education, our holding power was also very high. Now that was good from an educator standpoint, but all of these kids were staying in school, which meant that you dealt with pretty much the cross section of the teenagers. So we just had to deal with more problems and more difficult situations. It was a part of things that I related to, and of course the court cases, the one in Minnesota that's the Neville, Judge Neville ruling in the Little Falls case that practically told the school people that you have no right to be concerned about hairstyle or dress or appearance unless it affected the safety of other students. Well, then you went from 500 dress codes to none in about 1 year. Mm. It changed it that drastically. The job market had a lot to do with it. When the job market was good and when students were interested in the service, they had alternatives. But you remember during this protest period, the services were having a very difficult time to getting people into the service. So these kids, they either stayed in school or we didn't have that. They had no place to go, so mm-hmm. we had them, which was a blessing, and I think in the long run. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that one of the things that you missed when you moved to a larger school district was that sort of camaraderie with teachers. Was that the same phenomena that occurred between teachers and administrators? Did you have the same sort of camaraderie with administrators, and then that changed, or was that different?
Yes, that changed. It all seemed to be about the same pattern. If you look back in those beginning days, the superintendent was in the principal. They were all part of the faculty. They were all part of the same group. That changed. Oh, actually, the law. Well, I'll go back a step. In Minnesota, long about 1967, teacher organization began to get their right to negotiate laws and eventually the right to strike. And prior to that, the MEA was one big happy family of superintendents, principals, teachers, college education people, and it was one big group, and it was primarily educational in nature. There wasn't much of the negotiations or the union procedure involved. But along about that beginning of teacher power, the teacher unions in Minnesota began telling the MEA teachers that, look, this is a company union. You're being controlled by superintendents and administrators. And the teachers took that seriously, and they broke away. And the administrators broke away. And so then by 1970, you had separate organizations. You had the MEA for teachers. You had the Principals Association, the Superintendents Association, the Elementary School Principals Association. You had at least four different groups, whereas before you had one group. And that made a big break as far as the total staff was concerned. And I think that was true of even of smaller towns. At first, some of the administrators felt, well, gee, we can't. The teachers will be upset if we leave the MEA. But they found out later the teachers wanted them to leave. So it developed. That, in a sense, was a blessing, too, because it made the Superintendents Association, the Principals Association, better and stronger organizations than they were before when they were under the same umbrella.
Mm-hmm. What was the pattern of salaries during your career? Did you notice any particular point at which salaries skyrocketed, or where there's a significant change in the salaries of teachers or administrators?
Well, from my point of view, it seemed to be pretty gradual, is the old educational ladder philosophy, until about the early 70s when teachers started negotiating, when the right to negotiate became part of the law. And then you had some pretty significant developments in teacher pay, which eventually, the spinoff was helpful to administrators, too, because if the teachers got an X percentage raise, eventually the administrators get the same thing. So they had the benefits, and the teachers went through all of the difficulties and all of the negotiating. Mm-hmm. So we benefited from some of these laws that are designed to help teachers.
You previously mentioned the World War II and Sputnik and civil rights movements and Vietnam as some factors, outside factors, that had an impact on how schools operated and certainly on what students were doing. Any particular change related to the McCarthy era over your career, or book censorship